Okay, beloved saints. Hurry and gulp it down, Terry. Last thing you needed to have his cheeks full and half to smile at the same time. Okay. Beloved brethren of the Lord. Amen. Matthew chapter 13. We're looking now at the second parable given to the disciples in verses 45 and 46. I'm sorry? National. National. I said one possibility. Now, you know, it's almost endless when you go into different possible typology here, but it's possible that the field equals Israel, national Israel. And Jesus bought that. But the treasure is spiritual Israel. That is, the Israel by faith. Okay? But the best interpretation is that the field is the world and the treasure is the church. That's the best interpretation. The simplest, the best, the clearest interpretation. Okay. Okay. Let's see here. Now, verses 45 and 46. Again, the kingdom of heaven is likened to a merchant man seeking goodly pearls, who, when he had found one pearl of great price, went and sold all that he had and bought it. All right, now this is really similar to the previous parable. But now it's a pearl. And the pearl is usually sought for a king. They're about the only ones that could afford them. They came from the sea. And they were to be a part of kingly position. They were very expensive. And we see now a different type of search. The man going through the field, finding the treasure, that's not near the same search as a merchant going to find pearls. Now, where do you get pearls? All over the world. I mean, now we're talking about worldwide commerce. And I believe that the typology here is more clearly Jesus Christ searching for the Gentile church, looking for goodly pearls, looking for those from afar, you see, Gentiles from afar. He's going throughout the whole world and he's bringing them to God. He's buying them by giving his entire life for them and bringing them to God. And a couple of points here I think are interesting to note. Notice the environment of a pearl. It's in an unclean animal. And that's the Gentiles, see? Out there in the world, in an unclean environment. Whereas, the treasure is hidden in a field. And you can say, well, if that's the world, that's an unclean environment too. Yeah, that's true. In a sense, it's just that, it's taking a different view of it, really. And here we have the seeking for that, those saints that'll be part of the Gentile church, though, because of the wide search that's being done. And interesting thing, you know how a pearl is formed, don't you? It's because of the irritation to that oyster because of sand that gets inside. And because of the irritation, the oyster secretes a substance to cover it so it doesn't jab into its muscle. And it covers it, but now it's gotten a little bit bigger. And so now it's irritating, but it's not the same type of irritation, but it secretes some more. And then it gels around it, and it hardens, and then it secretes some more, and it gets bigger, and it gets bigger, and it keeps secreting, and you get a pretty big pearl, you know, given enough time. Yeah, it takes a little while, but given enough time, you can get quite a pearl. And that's exactly what happens to us. You know how we're formed? We're formed. We are perfected, brethren, and we become more valuable the greater the persecution and the suffering we go through in our worldly environment. We're an irritation to the world. And the greater the suffering, the greater the pearl becomes, the larger, and therefore the more valuable. It's interesting that the most valuable are either pink ones or black ones, because they're the rarest. And I don't know if we want to take the typology, maybe this is not in the picture, and you have to be really careful of what I'm just going to do. And maybe I shouldn't even do it, but I'm going to do it anyway. But you have to be careful of this, because you can't take a parable and then pull it for every little detail. Remember how I told you? Because you do and you get in trouble, and because you missed the main point. But I will say this, that a saint who is willing to be as Christ and to stand in the gap and to be a mediator, to become the goat that is black. Jesus Christ became sin for us. And if we are willing out of love to enter into the suffering of one another, we're like that valuable black pearl, you know. It's more valuable because it's more rare. It's really more rare for a Christian to be willing to enter in to the suffering in the heart of his brother. It's easy to kind of stay isolated. The pink one, that's red and white mixed. And the red, speaking of the blood. And Jesus has never asked us to give our own blood. But he has asked us to love not our life even unto the death, and that we love him. And he says, don't worry. He says, not one hair of your head shall be harmed. But then he says, but they shall persecute you and slay you. Right in the same context, in the next verse. And the point being that you will be kept and you don't need to worry, even though you go through physical suffering, even though you go through difficulty. But the Lord will preserve you. So, that's what I think this is talking about. Now, we can turn it around the other way and say that the man searching for the pearl is us. We're searching and we're looking for goodly pearls, and we found one, the pearl of great price. But see, I don't think that fits as well, even as the previous one, because now you've got many pearls. He's looking for goodly pearls. It kind of sounds like we're just looking around, you know, and we're trying all the different gods of the world, but we finally found one of great price. See, I don't think that's what's happening. Although you can take it that way, you can take it that we're looking for life and we found Jesus Christ, sold all that we have, but I think it fits better, Jesus searching for the pearl. And the pearl is the saints. Malachi 3 in verse 7, it says that ye shall be jewels and gems in his crown in the day that he makes up his crown. And so there the saints are called jewels. And we are to produce gold, silver, and precious gems. We are to produce that and to be like that. And the stones on the high priest's breastplate, they represent the saints. They represent the saints on the high priest's breastplate. And there is peculiar treasure. Okay. Now, down to the third parable to the disciples is in verses 47 through 50. This is the parable of the dragnet. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a net that was cast into the sea and gathered of every kind, which when it was full, they drew to shore and sat down and gathered the good into vessels, but cast the bad away. So shall it be at the end of the world. The angels shall come forth and sever the wicked from among the just, shall cast them into the furnace of fire. There shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth. The dragnet. Now, the thing about this kind of net is that it takes everything in its path. They have these things commercially. A very powerful boat will pull its metal mesh type of net, and it has a planer platform, or whatever you want to call it, a planer anyway, at the very bottom lip of that thing, and it's hydraulically run. And if you tilt it up, it'll bring that net right up to the top of the surface. If you tilt it down, as it's being pulled along, it just pushes it right down to the bottom. What they do is they push that thing right down to the bottom, and it just hits fast. And it goes right through an area, and it just takes everything in its way. Everything. to Dragnet. Now, they didn't have the same type of powerful boats to do all of that, but they'd circle and lay out a net in a horseshoe pattern, and they'd pull that thing in and just take everything in its way, whatever it was. Dragnet. And it's referring to the world being reaped at the end of time. And it's all drawn up. Notice it says, when the net is full, that's at the fullness of time. When the net is full, when everybody that will be born has been born and lived, and we're at the end of the millennium now, they'll all be drawn up. And the dragnet hits fast. They haven't got time to get out of it. That's the way judgment comes. It's just there. And then God will judge. God will judge. And this is also a view given to the disciples because this is God's view. Because the world isn't really going to see it quite like that. The angels are going to see it like that. I mean, it's a view from heaven. It's a heavenly viewpoint, like these other two also. Now, we've had three parables so far, and I think it's possible that these parables relate to, first of all, to the salvation of the Jews, parable of the treasure. Second of all, the salvation of the Gentiles, parable of the pearl. And then thirdly, the end of time when all is finished and the whole plan of God is fulfilled. The whole plan of God is fulfilled. Now, in these parables, we do not have a delineation between the second coming and the final judgment. We don't have that. Some of the parables, we may see that, but we don't in these. And a parable isn't trying to teach everything. It doesn't try to teach everything. It's just giving the basic concept, the overall concept. Jesus used the parable a lot. You know what that lets me know? Now, you know how we like to study, or at least how I like to study it often. You know, different ones like to study. You like to get it down, time keys, point one, point two, point three, get everything all in order. And this happens then, and then this happens, and the marriage feast is organized. You know, and that's what we do. We make our charts, and we've got it all lined out in the end of time. So you go into Apocalypse Daniel, and that's what you get. And that's a teacher's job to do that, you know. But it's interesting that Jesus, when he would teach, and we'll see that in Matthew 24 and 25, he just gave broad spectrums of truth. What does that tell you? He just gave broad spectrum of truth. You'll find something in the Christian life. Do you know what is the most important? And this is a shock to some people, particularly if you're kind of scholarly bent. But the most important thing you will ever learn, the majority of the revelation and truth that you will have, that you live with in your life, that makes the difference on how you live, is broad spectrum of truth. It's overall general revelation of heart and mind. And that's what Jesus gives. It's those revelations that affect how you live. Whether the marriage feast lasts 3.5 years, 7 years, or forever, I mean, that doesn't matter then. See? Whatever, you know, whether you're post-trib, pre-trib, you know, I mean, that doesn't matter as much as the general perspective and revelation that counts the most. And that's what will affect your life. That's why sometimes you find this kid, he's studying the Bible, God's going through like this, you know. But why? Why is he? What is it that he's really doing? And a man is made with a logical mind. He wants to fit it all together. I mean, you know, here he was, 2 years old. He got his toy. What's the first thing he does? Pulls off the wheels, pulls everything apart, looks at it. You know, he can't put them together yet. By the time he's four, he's starting to put them together. You know, what's the girl doing? She's not doing that to her dolls, pulling out the arms and seeing how it all works. She's not doing that. She's just playing with it. I mean, a man is made more like that. And so he will do that. But he has to be really careful. Because if he's not getting a revelation, a broad revelation of the heart of God, the mind of God that covers the whole thing, he'll miss it. And he'll go out and he'll be arguing about pre-trib, you know. And he's missing the point. He's missing the point. He's arguing about something that's way down the road. He should be back here talking about the first thing that needs to be taken care of. And that is unity of the Spirit. And then that other, we'll get to that later. But that's not the important thing now. It's easy to lose sight of where the heart of God is. But I see Jesus giving these basic revelations of truth. And to prepare the hearts of God's people. Okay, then we come to his last parable after he discusses with his disciples for just a moment. Look at verse 51. Jesus saith unto them, have ye understood all these things? They say to him, yea, Lord. I don't think they did. I'd like to read a parallel experience here in John 16, verses 28 to 32. Jesus says, I am come forth from the Father and am come into the world. Again, I leave the world and go to the Father. And did they know what he was talking about? Remember, his disciples did not even know that he would raise from the dead. Even though he told them several times, they just couldn't get it. And after he said this, I leave the world and go to the Father, his disciples said unto him, Lo, now speakest thou plainly, and speakest no proverb, or literally parable. You don't speak any parable now. Now are we sure that thou knowest all things, and needest not that any man should ask thee? By this we believe that thou camest forth from God. Jesus answered them, Do you now believe? So you think you really got it, huh? Do you really? Remember what Paul said? He said, Let every man know. Let's see. We all have knowledge, but he that knoweth does not yet know as he ought to know. He that has knowledge does not yet know as he ought to know. He knows nothing. Well, anyway, you know it. I can't quote it right now. So, and same thing here. Do you believe? You think you believe. You're getting something. You're getting some flashes in there, some lights sprinkling through, but do you really believe what you just said? Behold, the hour comes, yea, now is come, that ye shall be scattered, every man to his own, and shall leave me alone. And yet I am not alone, because the Father is with me. Do they understand? Well, kind of. Do you understand these things? Yea, Lord. They wanted to understand really bad. Their hearts were to understand. They were gobbling everything they could get, but they were not yet to that place. And see, that's we just have to be humbled about this, so we just understand what is God's real intent and the fullness of what is yet to come. So then he goes on, verse 52. Then said he unto them, Therefore, every scribe which is instructed unto the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man that is a householder, which brings forth out of his treasure things new and old. What he's basically saying, notice that word, therefore. They said, yeah, we understand, therefore. In other words, if you do understand, you are like a scribe instructed in the kingdom of heaven. A scribe, as you know, was one who had set his life apart to be an interpreter, an establisher of law and of interpretation. And he was one to develop and to interpret and to establish the law. That's what the scribes are for. That's why they were always on Christ's case, because he talked a lot of scripture, and they were supposed to be the ones that understood it all, see. And which they didn't at all. But a scribe which is instructed under the kingdom of heaven, that's the right kind of scribe. He is like a man that is a householder, which brings forth out of his treasure things new and old. Now, a householder has a treasure. A householder is a man that has valuables. He has wealth of sorts. And he has in his treasure things new and things old. And he's likening this to a scribe. If you really are going to understand the things of God, you have got to have in your treasure. And now remember, a scribe is a developer, an interpreter, an understander of the law of God. You've got to have in your understanding and in your spiritual perception things old and new. Now, what are these old and new things? Let me give you several possibilities, and I really think they all apply. Number one is the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law. The letter is the old. You got to know it, though. Because there are times to apply the letter of the law. The law is for the lawless. And it's righteous if you use it lawfully. But you need to see the intent behind it. So that's the new. That's the new application. You need to understand both. You need to have both. There's no virtue in just throwing away the Word of God because you've seen people that go to Bible college and they get dead, you know. No. Learn the Word of God. Get the Word under your belt, but stay in the Spirit and grow in the Spirit. That's the letter in the Spirit. Secondly, it's the Old Testament and the New Testament. That is the Old Covenant. You need to understand the Old Covenant, how God dealt with His people. In fact, a lot that we know about God, we get it from the Old Testament. As far as theology and so forth, you've got to know Him in the Spirit, though. See, then we come to the New Covenant. You need to understand the New Covenant. How now the blood has been shed of a perfect man. that is taking away the sin of the whole world, provisionally. And we need to understand the new covenant. You need to have things old and things new. You need to have old truths, therefore, and new revelation. And that's the third thing. You need to have old truths. You need to be founded on the old paths. Don't throw away what you know is true. But be open to new revelation. You need to have that too. So things old and things new. And another one is Israel in the flesh versus Israel in the spirit. We need to understand the revelation of Israel in the flesh. We need to understand Romans 9, 10, and 11. That's hard to understand by many people. We need to see where Israel, national Israel, fits in the plan of God. We do. We need to understand why God is dealing with Jerusalem the way He is. Why He's allowing these things to happen the way they do. But then we need to understand the Israel in the spirit. And the spiritual church. And those that are Jews indeed, whose circumcision is of the heart and not in the letter. So we need to understand that also. And finally, we need to understand Jesus as the root and the offspring. As the old and the new. See, as the root of David and the offspring of David. The Alpha and the Omega. You know, the first and the last. The same yesterday, today, and forever. Okay, before I leave this section, I want to give something to you that, again, I do a little bit with tongue in cheek, and that is this. I see seven parables. The eighth one sort of, you know, it's just exactly like the Beatitudes. The eighth one applies to all the previous seven. But the first seven have specific teaching and truth in them. And then the eighth applies to all the rest, you know, the persecution. Well, here, this eighth parable sort of fits for all the rest, things old and things new. You need to understand the revelation of these parables. It's possible, in my mind, that one of the new things in these parables is that it applies to the church ages. And I just want to give that to you. I think these seven parables possibly give us a historical picture of the church ages, seven church ages. Okay? And you can't, you know, press it in every detail, but I think the potential for this parallel is there. Now, I'm going to go fairly quickly, and you'll have to get your penny runners on and in order to get it all down. And never forget that one sister. I was just flying with notes, and she had her pen, and she was just going away and going away. And it ran out of ink, and she just, you know, I mean, everything was so intense. And I was just intense and, you know, and anointing and everything. And it ran out. Ah! And she, without realizing, she just screeched right in class. She kind of, you know, her pen ran out. I mean, life had come to an end. Her ink had failed. Certainly, the abomination of desolation has been set up, you know. And there's weeping and gnashing and wailing. I mean, the thing just struck her, you know. It wasn't just a matter of, oh, dear, I ran out of ink, you know, get another pen. I mean, it was like, ah! You can really get into this thing. Okay. Here you go. Got an extra pen handy? All right. What I'm going to do is I'm going to mention this parable, and then I'm going to give you the parallels in the church age. The first parable is the sower. Its parallel is with the Ephesian church age. And the date for that is 30 to 160 A.D. What do we see happening here? We see the gospel first going out. The gospel first goes out. And we see the different types of responses to the gospel. The different heart responses. And that's what happened in the Ephesian church age. And there's many that brought forth good fruit. Some 100, some 60, some 30-fold. There's some that the devil stole it out of their hearts, and there's others that were short committed, and there was others that let thorns grow too and turned into false prophets and things. But there's many that had good fruit. The second parable is the wheat and the tares. Its parallel is with the Smyrna church age. The date for that is 160 to 313 A.D. It's during this time that we find mixture. The devil came along and sowed next to the good seed. And there's a beginning of mixture. But you can't separate it out yet. It's just too intermingled. And you'll see during this time the rise of Gnosticism in a great way. You'll see Logos Christology, which later came to root in the Trinitarian concepts. There's a lot of discussion of the nature of Christ. You also see many warnings, even in the epistles of John, and he wrote just towards the end of the Ephesian church age, but warning the saints for the mixture that was going to be coming. And so that's what I see happening during this time. Now, in the Smyrna church age, there was a lot of... But you couldn't separate it out yet. It's not until the church councils later that things started getting separated out, and we see a lot of it bad. But and a lot of the good squelched. But at this time, it's just kind of all together. Let both grow together till the harvest. I mean, that's where you're stuck, wheat and the tares. The third parable is the mustard seed. And that's the time of the Pergamos church age, 313 to 606. 606 is the time of the first... 313 is the time of the first church council, and 606 is the time of the first pope. But what we have during this time is a phenomenal growth of the church. Phenomenal. It spread around the kingdom. It was during this time we have Constantine's Edict of Toleration. We see the world system growing so large that even unclean birds start lodging in its branches. There's a tremendous mixture. Catholicism really gels during this time. Augustine lived during this time, and he had a tremendous impact in the development of the Catholic Church in some ways. He had a lot of spiritual insight. Augustine is an interesting sort of fellow because he had a lot of spiritual insight, but he's definitely a Catholic. I mean, there's just a real spirit in him that just lends right towards Catholicism. He talks about others that were speaking in tongues and doing miracles and prophecy, but he doesn't mention him ever doing it. It was kind of one of those situations. It was also during this time that the doctrine of Mary, the Mother of God, came out. Okay, then the fourth parable is the leaven. And this is the period of the Thyatira church age that starts from the first pope until the Reformation, 606 through 1517. 606 to 1517. Now, it's during this time that the Athanasius Creed was developed, and that's where the Trinity becomes established. Dates are 606 to 1517. 1517 is the 95 Theses. That's the date of the 95 Theses that Martin Luther put on his church in Gutenberg. The door of his church that one morning, everybody came up and read them and realized, whoop, the war has been declared. Okay, so that's the 11. The fifth parable is the hidden treasure. And that's parallels with the Sardis church age. That begins with the 95 thesis of Luther in 1517 up to... the Pentecostal outpouring. So that, usually they put that at 1901, anywhere from 1850 to 1901. And during the Sardis church age, you see that there are many that sold all to buy that treasure, you know, and that Jesus found treasure, too, either way you take it. It mentions in the Sardis church age that there are a few names who are not defiled because they were able to come out. They were coming out of the system. And that's when hid treasure was being found. Still hidden. It's hidden in the field. And that's the period of the Reformation. And then sixth parable is the goodly pearl. And that parallels with the Philadelphia church age, which goes from the Pentecostal movement, 1901, until the rapture. And basically we find Christ finding the man-child and taking him for the king during this period. Pearl of great price. He had to search throughout the whole world, and I think this may apply to the gospel being preached into all the world, and then the end comes. And there's no rebuke to this church age. And then the seventh parable is the dragnet. The dragnet applies to the Laodicean church age, and that's from some period before the rapture until the end of the tribulation, the Great Tribulation. And we see that this is a time of great separation, and it's the fullness of the end. I mean, it's the end when the net is finally full and the time of the Lord is come. And that's when judgment is meted out, judgment on the church, judgment on the world, and then finally the second coming. And so the dragnet sort of takes you right up on to the end when everything is wrapped up. Not including the millennium in this view. Yes? From before the rapture. Because the Laodicean church age is forming. There's a lot of fight. There is a lot of fight. There's between unsubmissiveness and authoritarianism. Those are the two extremes. You got unsubmissiveness over here, and you got authoritarianism over here, and there's a fight going on. And there's a lot more authoritarianism in some ways, in different places, and there's a lot more unsubmissiveness. And I tell you, Laodicea is fighting hard to get born, you know. Laodicea is on the rampage. It wants to come in. It wants to have its way. Rule of the people. And actually, both extremes fit real well in Laodicea. People's rights. Demanding rights, either by those in leadership or those among the church. But you know what the heart of Christ is submission one to another in the fear of Christ. Submitting one to another in the fear of Christ. That's the heart of God. Not a control on either party. Okay, so that's sort of a picture. Now it's interesting to me if what I'm giving you is true. It's interesting to me that Jesus, in his parables, and particularly in the ones that he gives, actually could possibly give a picture of the history of the church. History of the church. And if he did that there, my, what else did he do everywhere else? I mean, you know, there's hidden things in these parables. There is. Insights, if we can be open to them. Question? Right. Right. It's just in a different view now. It's just a different point. It doesn't make any distinction. See, maybe that's one of the reasons why both apply. I found that with some of the parables, that depending on how you look at them, they could fit either judgment, because there's clearly a judgment at the end of time. I mean, at the end of the 6 days allotted to man, very clearly a judgment. And yet the white throne judgment, in which all the dead are set before the throne, that's not until the end of the millennium. And just a quick diagram here. The reason why is because we've got the 6 days of man in the period of history. During this whole period, everybody that died went into Sheol. Everybody. Whether you're righteous or unrighteous. At the time of Christ's resurrection, those that were in the righteous spot went up into glory. And so now paradise is up here, you know. And it's not down here anymore. But all these ages, everybody that died is emptied into here, except now they emptied two places. The righteous go up here, but the unrighteous still go down here. Including during the millennium. So all these guys haven't been judged yet. And these have not received a glorified body yet. They haven't, except for the raptured saints. And at the rapture is when the saints receive these. Didn't Christ rise first? And they which are alive and remain are caught up with them, meet the Lord in the air, glory. Yeah. It's going to happen. One day it's going to happen. So they receive a glorified body, so let's just put it like this. They receive a glorified body, but the righteous that died during the millennium probably aren't. They're probably going to go into this place. They'll probably go into that place. And these keep going to this place. And it's not until the final white throne judgment. See, that's when the throne, you know. That's when God's throne. As far as
finally said is at the millennium, okay? At the end of the millennium. But there is a definite judgment right here, definite, on the earth. Definite judgment. And so both can fit. It just depends on the view you take. And see, I see that with a lot of prophecies in the Old Testament. A lot of prophecies in the Old Testament, they don't make a distinction. They say one judgment. And they don't make a distinction between the comings of Christ. The first or the second coming, either. Just having one coming. And they have one judgment. But in history, historically, there's two comings and there's two judgments.
Those guys in time,
yeah.
Do you think the people who die are rushed ahead? You know what I mean? If we turn on the time, because there's no time, they're not sitting around waiting for us.
Right.
Do you think
they're
pushed on ahead and
they've
already
done
all of that?
Okay, I've thought of that myself. That's interesting that you think about that. In other words, when you go into glory, do you just enter into the realm that God is in?
Yeah, you go automatically to the white throne and you're...
And it's all over.
Yeah.
Two things I'll say about that. Number one, there is a judgment as soon as you die. Because you either go to a place of rest or a place of torment as soon as you die. But the torment is a prison house. It's not the lake of fire. Because the prison house itself gets cast into the lake of fire. Sheol itself goes into the lake of fire. And see, the only ones that are left in here are the unrighteous. They are not judged until the white throne judgment. So it says all the dead. But there are other parables and other teachings that show that the righteous are going to be there at the white throne also. And it's what's I think is this. I think, and there's different philosophies, and maybe when you get saved, you're in that realm without time, and maybe it'll be different. You know, maybe it won't be quite like that. But those that enter into a glorified body, they have their reward. They have their reward. They have entered into their reward, their inheritance at that point. And how much else is involved, part of their reward is reserved till after the millennium for everybody, because their reward is partly their position on the new heavens and the new earth. And that is not brought into being until after this one's all burned up. And so even the righteous are dependent upon the white throne judgment for some things. For some things. And so I feel that the white throne judgment is in time and the saints will have to wait until that time for some things. But for other things, they receive it at the rapture. But then there are many other saints that have to wait until the white throne. And then all of us have to wait until there's a final reward, until the new heaven and the new earth. All that's brought into being. And definitely the saints do not... What I thought you were first asking is what I thought about at times, and that is, if you enter into that realm, you just immediately zip up in time. And I don't believe that, personally.
So they're waiting. So Paul has to wait thousands of years while we're for us.
Right. He's waiting. We're all waiting. Okay. And when you get up there at the rapture, you'll be waiting. Of course, Paul's not resurrected yet, see.
Okay.
Paul's not?
It's
in paradise. But they're not resurrected yet. Paradise is caught up, but they're not resurrected yet. We'll talk more about this later when I get into the parable of Dies and Lazarus. But the angels don't zip ahead in time. The angels don't zip ahead in time, as far as I can tell. Neither do demons, and so I'm sure we don't either.
So there's a sense of time up there.
Yeah.
They have to be.
At that point.
They're still close to earth because they're not resurrected.
In relationship to this, there's a sense of time. But how that is, it's probably more like 1,000 years as a day, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Could be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, when you're having a good time, time flies, you know. Yeah. Where does it come from? Is that where they get the idea of purgatory? I think the purgatory the Catholics believe in is a mixture of some heathen philosophy. Heathen philosophy of a place. I mean, as far as scriptures, they don't have any. So they do use a couple, but they don't have any. We're saved by fire, it says in 1 Corinthians 3. I mean, total misinterpretation of that one. But the second thing is They're almost forced to it because of their theology. Their theology is that there's a partial salvation. You're always partially saved. You're never fully saved. Because if you quit taking the Mass, you're damned. In fact, they used to believe, and I think they've really loosened up on it now, but if you're a perfect Christian all your life, but you miss your last Mass, and then you die suddenly, tough luck, Charlie. If you didn't get your absolute, whatever it is, absolution or whatever, by the priest, if the priest did not absolve you of your sins before you died, you go to hell. And then different ones believe that, well, you just burn longer in purgatory. But see, everybody has, you know, it's a partial salvation because you're saved only through the priest and the Mass. You withdraw the Mass. That's why whole countries would absolutely go berserk when the priest withdrew the Mass. Because without the Mass, they'd all go to hell. It doesn't matter how many Masses you had up to that point. You miss them now, you're damned. And so what they did during the war, now wartime, that's bad news. And so what they do is that priests in America would offer to give Masses for your son, you know, here. And it would be okay, because God would accept that. So you could save your son by having Masses here. For $40, you could save your son. You'd have a Mass here for your son overseas, so in case he dies. I mean, it's just a horrible, horrible theology. People are always living under that. Yeah, now.
Is it possible that they would not go be cast into the lake of fire?
No. Everybody that's in Sheol will go into the lake of fire, according to the scripture. Because now the only ones that are going there are wicked.
Well, then.
Paradise used to be a part of Sheol. Mm-hmm. But now paradise is caught up, so it's not a part of Sheol anymore. Today you should be with me in paradise, Jesus said.
Yeah.
Where'd he go? Down. But later, when Paul went to paradise, where did he go? Up. Jesus led captivity captive. I'll cover this all later. How did I get into that? I don't know how I got into it. Oh, I know how I got into it. Talking about judgment. So, Charles, it's all your fault. Point is that it can have two views, because both is a judgment. All right. Unless there's something really necessary that we need to understand, we'll be covering this later about Sheol. I just assume you hold that on. If there's anything else on this, you could ask. Okay.
So,
yeah.
Just one real quickie.
Sure.
Okay, you were just talking about eight parables.
Yes.
I know there's got to be more than eight parables, because you know, like 10 virgins and all these
other things. Oh, sure. There's about 80 some.
Are you just talking about eight parables in Matthew 13?
Right, in Matthew 13.
Okay.
Yeah, in this particular time that he taught them eight. Mm-hmm. Gave them eight. All right. Well, what happens after this, I'm just going to read the end of the chapter, verses 53 through 58. It came to pass that when Jesus had finished these parables, he departed thence. When he was come into his own country, he taught them in their synagogue, insomuch that they were astonished, and said, Whence hath this man this wisdom and these mighty works? Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary, and his brethren James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? He had four brothers and sisters. And his sisters, are they not all with us? And so there was at least seven in the family, seven children at least, and very possibly more. And his sisters, are they not all with us? Whence then hath this man all these things? And they were offended in him. But Jesus said unto them, A prophet is not without honor, save in his own country and in his own house. And he did not many mighty works there because of their unbelief. There's a saying that goes, quote, Fame fades at the family hearth. End of quote. You know, he can be great, mighty Dr. So-and-so, but at home he's Charlie. He can have mighty gifts of healing when he's out on the road evangelizing and he's up there ministering and preaching, but when he comes home to mom and dad, they argue religion. You know what I mean? It's just, he's just John then. And it's interesting that they just knew him too well in the flesh, as it were. It seemed like their knowledge of him after the natural was just too much for them to overcome. Which lets you know that if you knew him in the natural, it may be a disadvantage. It may be a disadvantage. Some people think, if I could only be back there with him then. No. You have Him much closer now. You have Him much closer now. It's much better to have Him living inside. That is, the apostles would have told you that at Pentecost. They'd have said, oh, this is wonderful. And that's what He wants to be. He wants to be inside. So, they didn't believe because they walked by sight. It's interesting that God's will is done everywhere, in heaven, and all over His creation, except one place, man. Man. And it seems like the more, quote, familiar you get with God, it's just too easy in a natural way. You see, a lot of the churches like this. They know Him too much in the natural. Do you know what I mean? He's just kind of God's buddy-buddy, and He just... Now, I don't mean to not take the Lord into confidence in every part of your life and make Him your friend, because we should. We need to. In fact, that's really a deep relationship. But I mean just the knowledge of, you know, the churches and Christianity and God's in heaven and I know Jesus saves and all of that can become kind of familiar. See, a church can raise a gospel-hardened generation. The church can raise a gospel-hardened generation. And many times, the worst kids are the preacher's kids and the Sunday school teacher's kids and those that have the greatest concern about doing things right spiritually. Many times, their kids are the worst kids. And it's because of the external, the emphasis on the external, and they get the whole wrong view of God, and they come out of it with a completely different relationship to God than their parents have. See? And it's very true. It's happened a lot around here, too. It's happened in my life. But the Lord is repairing. His mercy endures forever. Okay. So, we jump out of Matthew 13 and we step over to Mark chapter 5 and settle on down in verse 1. Verses 1 through 20 in Mark chapter 5. Spiritual perspectives from the healing of the Gadarene. Gadarene demoniac. We find parallels also in Matthew chapter 8 and in Luke chapter 8. Now I'm going to draw spiritual perspectives out of this because in this story we clearly see the parallel to our day and our age and our life. Mark 5 verse 1. And they came over unto the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gadarenes. That's, as you know, on the southeast corner of the Sea of Galilee, where the Gadarenes were, kind of a hilly area. It had some pretty steep bluffs, but you know, there'd also be valleys and ways that you could get up off of the water. It was more steep along that area, though. And when he was come out of the ship, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. Immediately he met him. Not a while later. Because Satan is walking about, seeking whom he may devour. And Satan was immediately aware that Jesus Christ was there, the Son of God. And it was a man with an unclean spirit. I think this is interesting. Demons are called unclean. You ever heard that cleanliness is next to godliness? Do you know that of all the infections we get in the body, 74% come through the eyes? Because they blink down from the moisture in the eyes and go down to the nose. And in the nose, it basically incubates them. And they can spread to the body, different types. We get a lot of sinus ones, you know. And you know how it gets there? Largely by rubbing your eyes. Because your hands, because they're touching a lot of things, get a lot of germs on them. A lot of bacteria and a lot of viruses on your hands. And that uncleanness, that's why it's so important to keep your hands washed. So important to keep yourself clean. And the bacteria, you know, a foul smell is evidence of bacteria. A lot of bacteria. So, uncleanness. Satan feeds on uncleanness. He loves uncleanness. He loves filth. He loves it. That's where he lives and moves. He likes it. That's why we're going to see later he wanted to go into these pigs. He likes uncleanness. He does. He loves unclean meat. He loves it. He loves anything that's unclean, anything that's bad for you. He doesn't like milk and honey. He likes garbage and filth. That's what he likes. From the parallel passages, we also see the man was naked. He had no clothes. And there was no shame. And this is also what we see the devil do. He strips people of their righteousness. He doesn't want you to have any righteousness. He wants you shamed. He wants you exposing your shame. The Bible calls the private parts your shame. And the devil loves to expose your shame. He wants everybody to see your shame and for you not to be ashamed. If you were ashamed and repentant, God would cover it. If you're not ashamed, it's just exposed, and it's like the New Testament says, the heathen, they glory in their shame. The thing that shames them is what they glory in. They boast in it. They boast in it. They brag on what they did. You know, they brag on it. They boast in it. It's wonderful to them. Verse 3. Who had his dwelling among the tombs, and no man could bind him, no, not with chains. His dwelling was among the tombs. Now, these are not the tombs like a cemetery with the tombstones and you run around on top of the grass. It's not that way at all. The tombs were caves. And particularly in this area, you know, it'd be kind of steep coming up from the water. Here's the water, and it'd be kind of steep coming up, maybe. And there'd be tombs that would be back in there. And on these tombs, they would make shelves. They'd hollow out shelves. And they would lay bodies on these shelves. And sometimes, you know, it'd be on both sides and wherever. It'd depend on the configuration of the cave. And sometimes they would, you know, as it get filled up, they'd take some of the deader ones. They'd take some of the more decomposed, whatever, the old ones. They'd take them out and burn and make room for other ones to come in there. But these would be their tombs. And you had to bury a body right away, quickly. And they wouldn't bury him in the ground. They'd take him into these caves. This is where this guy lived. He lived in these tombs around all these dead bodies. It's the uncleanness. That's where he lived. And the devil loves to associate with darkness, because in these caves is darkness. He loves darkness because fear is spawned in darkness. In Jude verse 6, it says that demons are bound in chains of darkness. That's why they love darkness. They wish everybody on the face of the earth could be blind. They would love it. They'd love to shut out the light of the sun. They don't like us getting light. The whole world gets life and breath and all things from God. The demons hate that. They like to kill. They like to destroy. They love things that associate with death and dying. They love it. They feel at home in the hospitals and people are dying. They love to kill people with cancers. That's their delight. They're also morbid. Demons are morbid. They love morbidity and negativeness. They love things that are negative and down. They love all of that. That's why a witch's brew is not out of peppermint candy and juice, you know, brewing. It's out of filthy water and spiders and spiders webs and bats eyes and snake tails and worse than that. They love that filth. And no man could bind him. You can't bind the devil. A man can't bind the devil. You can't bind demons. A man can't. They're bigger than you are. They trick us all the time. If we walk in the Spirit and are humble in humility before God, can we overcome them. But that's the only way. In ourselves, we are no match for demons. No match. One demon could make a total fool out of you. Just one. And they couldn't even bind him with chains, meaning he could bust the chains. And Satan can energize people to go to the absolute ultimate of that body's capabilities of strength. Now, they can't, you know, make that body so strong it can move the earth over or something, or move a mountain or something like that. But it could bust chains. So these chains weren't, you know, 130-pound link chains like they have down here on these ships in the Sound. Those links are 130 pounds each, those things. And there's some even bigger than that stand as tall as a man. So they weren't that big, but they were chains that they would make, and they could actually break those chains. Okay, let's go. Yes. Back at I'm not really sure if they've done it these days, but back at thanks. Back at the time of Henry the Fifth, I think, King Philip. They're playing a lot of shenanigans in I think like in 1400s, particularly 1300s. There were times really that they did this.